This week on the show, cage fighting, the Bing box, and if you work for the man, you better be careful what you say over email. All this on This Week in Media, episode 189. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back with another episode of This Week in Media. I am Daisy Whitney, and I'm hosting this week. I don't always host. Sometimes it's Alex, sometimes it's me, sometimes it's Tim. But you've got me this week, and we are coming to you just via audio, as you know, because you're listening to this. And it is good to be back. My co-host, Alex, was here last week. He's off this week, but I have my other co-host, Tim Street. How are you? How is L.A.? How is your new gig at MDialogue?
Oh, I'm doing great. I just got back to L.A. from San Francisco. I was in San Francisco for two events. One was the closing of House of Shields, which has been like this San Francisco Web 2.0 bar that Shlomo Rabinowitz runs. And so it was fun seeing a lot of people there. And then I was also there for the Revision 3 fifth anniversary party, which was a lot of fun, a lot of web video celebrities there, including Callie Lewis, who's going to have a new show on Revision 3 as well.
I know, isn't that amazing? Revision 3 has been busy, and 5 years is incredible. That's some staying power, especially when we look at others who haven't made it, and the challenges that Revision 3 itself faced a couple of years ago when everything went to hell with the economy. I mean, so it's good to see that the company's still kicking and still hiring.
Very cool.
And also we've got Lon Seidman from Connecticut. Lon's kind of become a regular, so it's good to have you here. Lon is with Local Online News TV. How's everything going?
Everything is going great. It's always good to be here, and we're slogging it out every day.
All right. Well, thank you for being back. And we also have Mark Frauenfelder. Mark, I think you were on the show once before. I wasn't on at the time. So welcome. Mark is with Boing Boing. How are you? You're in L.A. as well.
Yeah, I'm in L.A. Things are going really well. Thanks, Daisy.
Nice. Well, I'm glad to have you here. All right, so we're going to jump right into things. This is going to be kind of a little bit of a shorter show than our audience is used to, but we are going to deliver everything you need to know in about 35 minutes. Judge sides with Google in the $1 billion Viacom lawsuit. This is big news late last week. I think it's still important that we touch on it. Most of you know that a federal judge in New York sided with Google. It was a $1 billion copyright lawsuit. This had been going on for 2 or 3 years. You know, lots of back and forth, as you would expect in a lawsuit of this size, been filed by Viacom over what Viacom said were copyrighted videos that were on the YouTube site. So without going through all of the details of the motion, I guess one of the big things is, do we think this will hold up? Lon, I'm going to start with you today. I mean, this is a lawsuit. We already know it. I mean, it's already going to go to appeals and all of that. So does this matter yet? Or do we think this will hold up?
I think in the end, it probably will hold up. You know, a lot of what is being challenged here, and certainly there's a lot of details of this case that we won't go into, but on the surface, you know, I see it as a challenge against, you know, the Telecommunications Act of 96, which has been around for a while now, and I think is largely held up in its components. The other thing I see, you know, that is different since this lawsuit was first filed, was the fact that a lot of publishers, you know, of high-end, you know, commercial content like music and videos and whatnot are starting to recognize there's some value to letting the users of YouTube post whatever they want and then attach their advertising to it or their link to buy the song. You'll see that happen quite a bit when a copyright holder recognizes that some song in a video belongs to them, and all of a sudden there's a little pop-up ad that lets people buy the song. So, you know, I'm surprised it hasn't been settled yet, but I think it'll probably hold up. I do think, though, especially when we talk about safe harbor for people listening to the show who are content creators, is to make sure that the content you're creating is conforming with the safe harbor laws in that piece of legislation, because it's very easy to get yourself sued if you're not following exactly what the law prescribes as to how to deal with this kind of content.
Well, Mark, how big a deal is it that YouTube has cleaned up its act over the last few years and has done a lot of above board deals with content creators and has done things in conjunction with copyright holders? I mean, even think about, you know, with Chris Brown, when that JK Wedding Dance became so popular, right away, YouTube figured out how to monetize that.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it definitely helps, but it really is impossible for them to stay on top of everything. You know, YouTube gets 29 hours worth of video uploaded every single minute. So there's no way that they can stay on top of everything. I mean, the lawsuit, it's been a very dirty lawsuit from the get-go. You know, there were Cory Doctorow, my colleague on Boing Boing, looked at some of the case filings. And it showed that Viacom was paying marketing companies to secretly upload Viacom's videos to YouTube and kind of roughing them up so that they looked like they were pirated videos. I mean, the whole thing was, I think Viacom just wanted to own YouTube because they were upset that they didn't get there first. And, you know, you look at some of the emails in the case filings, and it's these Viacom executives arguing with each other over who gets to run YouTube once they get it.
It's so that's the best part of lawsuits, of covering them, isn't it? Is getting to see the emails that get unearthed in lawsuits. I mean, it's even, you know, that if you think about the things that have been going on with Facebook recently and privacy, I mean, getting to see Mark Zuckerberg's emails. Tim, how big a victory is this for creators?
I don't know that it is a victory for creators. You know, it's kind of a bummer to think that it's okay for somebody to build a business on taking your content and making you as a content creator let them know that somebody has stolen it. You know, it's a great business model, and they've done really well with it. But from a content creator standpoint, man, does that stink? You know, you have to send them a cease and desist letter and tell them that your content is stolen. So that means that you have to have somebody that's out there looking for it. I mean, sure, you can set Google alerts and find it, but then you have to take the time and effort to get that cease and desist there. And that's a little bit frustrating. So I don't know that it's a win for independent content creators. Unless you're an independent content creator who deals in the dark side of it by taking other people's content and putting it on YouTube.
Well, lots of interesting points of view. Other in other tangos and sort of back and forth, interesting story in the Register about Twitter reaching a settlement with the FTC over privacy lapses. Basically, Twitter has agreed to overhaul its data security practices to settle federal charges that shoddy password policies and other lapses at the microblogging site exposed its users' private information. Obviously, that's from the Register story. This was basically a settlement reached with the FTC. And now Twitter has to establish what's called a comprehensive information security program. It's going to be assessed by a third party every year over the next decade. And essentially, there had been you know, several hacks, first of which occurred in January. And a lot of these centered around Twitter employees using their own personal emails. And it just became very easy for the passwords to be found by hackers. So, Lon, first question, how foolish were these Twitter processes in the first place?
Well, I guess the password was pretty easy to guess, right? So, you know, that's the first thing that I always tell, you know, people around our organization, like, you know, stop using your birthday or something really obvious, especially if you're on TV talking about your birthday or whatever. So, or Facebook for that matter. So, you know, that's a problem right there. You know, the other thing though that I see with this, which is more serious, is this is a federal agency basically asking a private website operator or you know, network operator to basically regulate its policies according to something that they want. I don't know. And, you know,
why is that concerning?
Well, it just, you know, we talk so much about how the internet's so unregulated and, you know, all these fears about the government stepping into how, you know, the internet is operated. And here we go with something really that I don't see any legislation out there allowing the FTC to essentially, you know, tell Twitter how to operate. And that kind of concerns me. We're seeing a lot more now with the cybersecurity bill last week as well. You know, the federal government is slowly, you know, inching its way towards some greater regulatory controls. And the one regulatory control that myself and many content providers want to see is that of net neutrality, which kind of hangs in the balance for a while. You know, so I wonder if part of the issue is that, you know, Congress certainly needs to step up and do some proactive work on trying to define some boundaries here, but also the fact that, you know, Twitter so quickly just relinquished their control to an FTC request, essentially. So it, I mean, certainly they have to be more secure, but it just concerns me that the government is the one making the request, and it's being settled as a way to get out of this.
Mark, do you have similar concerns, and do you think that there are legitimate privacy issues that do need to be kept under watch?
Yeah, I do think there are, and you know, it also upsets me that the Twitters and Facebooks of the world are so lax with their security that the government kind of has no option but to step in and start regulating, which, you know, to me is not a good thing. If they don't police themselves, then somebody's going to do it. And so, you know, when the government starts doing it, we're going to end up with something that is possibly a lot worse than what would have happened if these companies would have just stepped up and integrated a little, you know, implemented better security measures to begin with.
It's their own fault. I mean, they should have done a better job in a way, and sort of they're causing something to happen that may not be the best solution.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, through sloppiness now, they're inviting a government solution, and government solutions, as we all know, aren't always the best for everybody.
Tim, what do you think? Will this impact usage? And also, I mean, we hear about privacy sins all the time on Facebook and Twitter, and you are definitely, you know, very vocal and have strong opinions on privacy and kind of what we give up just being on the internet. So I guess, does this matter in the long run?
You have no privacy, especially if you work at a corporation that's going to get sued, because then all your emails are going to wind up on the internet anyway. So, yeah, it's I agree with both Lon and Mark. I mean, I think there are issues here that need to be paid attention to. It scares me that the government's involved, but it's Twitter's fault for not being, you know, strict enough.
Interesting point. All right, Sears and Kmart are kind of getting into the same game that a lot of other retailers are doing, like Best Buy and Walmart. CNET's Erica Ogg reported that Sears and Kmart have this new service, Alpha Line Entertainment. It's going to be available on devices from Sharp, LG, Sony, Samsung, Panasonic, and RCA. Basically, new digital streaming video. Customers will be able to go into the store. They'll be walked through the setup by customer service representatives, which is kind of similar to what Best Buy and Walmart are doing. And interestingly enough, Sears and Kmart are going to be using the same technology provider, Sonic Solutions, Roxio Now, which is a streaming and technology provider. And there are about 5,000 new release movies. It's interesting to see these kind of, you know, big mass market retailers getting into the game. And I wonder, you know, does that mean that retail is the future of connected TVs and web-to-TV streaming? Lon, what do you think?
Well, I think we thought Blu-ray versus HD DVD was bad. I mean, I just counted up in my house before we started. I have 5 different devices plugged into my television that can play movies, none of which are compatible with the other one. So I think that's immediately a big problem, because certainly in the past, getting any kind of adoption for a format standard has been a real challenge and has cost a lot of money. And I do feel, though, that, you know, especially for us and for everyone listening, that, you know, having the ability of the device to play content from the internet is really critical. So I'm happy to see it happening. I just wish there was more standardization and there was a better way to get our stuff easily front and center to people that have this stuff and are trying to figure out a way to use it.
What's the concern with standardization? Are your worry is that because there are so many folks offering these services now, that will make it harder for content creators to deliver to these different devices and end units?
Definitely. You know, we don't have a staff of programmers at localonlinenews.tv yet. You know, we're a small operation trying to get a foothold in a few communities. And, you know, every time there's a new box that comes out, I've got to figure out a way to get that content delivered to it. So, you know, already we have, a, you know, a little cookie cutter iPhone app. We've got, you know, a podcast stream. We have an RSS feed. But getting all that stuff to funnel into, let's say, a Roku box or to, you know, some other device that I'm not even thinking about just yet, you know, it's often difficult. So, you know, really, you know, when there's 12 or 15 different things, there's a lot of programmatic changes you have to make to get content onto those devices. You know, it gets to be a real challenge. So I'm hoping that there's at least some kind of curation, some standards, something that we can look towards. I'm kind of excited about the Google TV, actually. I think that might help get us there a little bit quicker, especially with Sony adopting it.
Mark, what do you think will be the uptake of these different types of services? I mean, do you think consumers want to go into a Sears or Kmart and have some kind of streaming video added onto their TV?
Well, I do think they want streaming video. You know, I guess it depends on the machine that does the streaming, the box. You know, I'm really happy with my new TiVo Premier box. It's got Amazon, it's got Netflix streaming, it has YouTube, it has Blockbuster. And, you know, the TiVo, it's basically an addressable computer, so new streaming services can be added to it when new ones become available. And so I think, you know, some kind of general purpose box or having the signal streamed from the family desktop machine is a better way to go than, you know, buying a dedicated box, because you don't want too many of them plugged in. I had that for a while where I had, you know, the Roku box and the TiVo and the Wii and all that stuff. But the more general purpose it is, I think the better. And, you know, I don't know. I don't think retailers are playing a smart game thinking that this is going to be a long-term business, a long-term solution for them or source of revenue for them to be selling services like this.
Why do you say that? You don't think that this will fare too well for them?
No, I don't think so. I mean, so what is it that when you go into, you know, the Sears or Kmart, are they selling you TVs with this technology baked into the sets? Or are they selling you boxes?
I think that's my understanding of it at this point, that you could buy a TV set and that it would be, you would be able to get these streaming services through it. You know, the sets are designed to be connected TVs, but because one of the most complicated parts is often figuring out, you know, how to actually get it to work. I believe the thinking is, let's make it work in the store. Let's send the customers out already knowing how to do this. We'll see.
Well, I don't know if that's such a great business for retailers to be getting into.
Tim, what do you think? Is this something that is going to thwart the dreams of Roku, or do you think it'll be much ado about nothing?
I am so glad you explained this, because I thought you were going to have to go to Sears or Kmart to watch a show. And I was like, you know, this is really kind of backwards to me. I don't think it's going to work out too good. I actually used to be a store detective at Kmart when I was in college.
Good. And what were you looking for, to see if people were shoplifting or just how
shoplifting.
Wow.
I got to do fun stuff there. I actually spent the night in the store and spied on the cleaning staff, too. That was fun.
Anything tawdry? Any tawdry tales to share?
Yes, but I can't. This is a family. This is a safe show. There are actually things that happened in a Kmart, believe it or not, that are lascivious, I think, the word there. But as far as this goes, I think it's good for video consumption. The thing that a lot of people are getting hung up on is all these different platforms, all these different formats. I think that's the crazy part, because if you take a look at DVD, you didn't go to Kmart and buy one type of DVD and then go to Walmart or Target and buy another type of DVD. They were standardized, and you just bought a DVD anywhere, and as a content creator, you just had your DVDs available anywhere. And I think we're in this early stage here where everybody's jockeying for whatever the platform is going to be, whose platform it's going to be on. And eventually it's going to be standardized so that the content creators can create one thing, and that one thing may be available in TV sets that are sold at Kmart or sold at Walmart or sold at Sears. But we're going to have to suffer through this right now with all these different boxes and all these different gadgets just because it's new and everybody's fighting for it. And eventually one format will win out.
All right. Well, we'll see how that plays out. Now, fans have often wanted to get involved with writing and designing, creating movies and so on. And Sci-Fi is a network that particularly has a lot of vocal fans. So Hollywood Reporter recently wrote that Sci-Fi is going to be giving online fans a chance to write and design every aspect of an upcoming Saturday Night Creature feature. The cable network is basically launching a production site. It's called B-Movie Mogul. Fans can vote, pitch ideas for the film, from title, creatures, wardrobe, dialogue, and character deaths, even to promotional taglines. Kind of cool. The resulting script that comes up will be shot as a two-hour Sci-Fi original movie. So, Lon, does this just mean it's going to be a Frankenstein of a movie?
Well, they picked the right genre, right? A B-movie, certainly. You know, I wouldn't expect a high-quality drama out of this project, but it sounds kind of fun. Getting people involved and active in creating content, especially something that's going to air on a pretty popular cable network, it sounds kind of fun. So I'm looking forward to following this. There's actually a group of professionals out there called Rec-A-Movie. I don't know if you've heard of them before or not.
No.
But they actually have been creating distributed films where people produce different portions of the film and kind of collaborate online to put the whole project together. And I think they're actually working on a pretty sizable science fiction comedy right now. Something about the Germans, you know, landing on the moon and coming back to reinvade Earth or something. It looks really cool. So this is kind of a take on that. Certainly this is more having fans writing and having the production done somewhere else. But I think this distributed filmmaking is something that we're going to see a lot more of.
Mark, how do you think this compares to other efforts in the past to enlist the masses in the creative process?
Well, you know, I think it's probably going to be similar to other kinds of collaborative ventures where it really should be a single person's creative vision. It's not going to be that good. You know, you see what happens in Hollywood when scripts get turned over from person to person to person, and it's just a mess, and it's nothing like the fantastic book that the movie was based on. I think it would have been more fun to have a contest where people could just enter and they would pick one person at random and have them write the script and design the costumes and do everything. It probably wouldn't be good, but it would be interesting. You know, it would be more interesting to see a single person's vision than kind of a crowdsourced movie.
Or what could be interesting is if the different parts of the film were apportioned. You know, one person did the script, one did the costumes, one did the promos or something.
Sure.
You could see that because then you can involve more than one person, but perhaps it's less risky. Tim, what do you think? Do these fan-made ventures ever work well?
Well, I'm usually pretty skeptical of this kind of stuff. I think that things die in committee and you need a driving force. Now, that said, there have been examples of where throughout history this has worked out. There's this one book, I'll think of the name of it in a second, but different people worked on this book at different times in different places. And eventually one guy, I think his name was King James, he kind of brought it together and I heard it got pretty popular. And people still, you know, it's been around for a while. People still read it today and it worked out okay. But it was really the curator, that King James guy, that brought it together and made it work. So you got to have that one driving force to bring things together. And maybe Sci-Fi is going to do that.
That's an interesting point. Maybe they'll listen to the show and realize, oh, that's what we need. We need a ringleader. Because what you're saying is that ventures like this are challenging. You can wind up with a Frankenstein of a project. But to avoid doing that, you have to have one person who has some kind of ownership stake in it to be able to kind of pull all the parts together. So we'll obviously keep tracking it and see how that pans out as Sci-Fi goes down that path. Bing released a new version of the search engine. Fast Company reported on this and said, of course, it might not be on Google's level, but it's an effective tool that's gaining market share. Basically, the new Bing release is really focused on some new entertainment features. And that's, of course, important to Microsoft with the plays that it's making, obviously, very strong play in the gaming business and also is you know, has interest clearly in music and so on. But we have a lot of updates and upgrades when it comes to music, games, TV, movies, etc. Lon, you had some interesting thoughts on kind of what Bing has done, offering this free Top 100s by the Year app. Tell us a little bit about that and kind of what you think about this new release.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I think Microsoft is actually doing pretty well in areas where it doesn't totally dominate the industry, which, you know, you look at the Xbox, you know, certainly they're ahead, but not the clear dominant market leader, you know, Nintendo is, but Xbox 360 is an amazing product. And with Bing, you know, they really set out not to destroy Google, but just, you know, pick off a few percentage points of its market share, which I think they've successfully done. And, you know, the music streaming is certainly a nice development. They've also been dropping some apps into the iPhone world. And I believe they actually did this through an acquisition, but they have a music app called the Top 100s by Year. So you can go on the App Store, look for that. It's by Bing. I think they want you to install the Bing app also. And what it does is gives you the top 100 songs played randomly for a decade or a year that you choose from 1947 to the current year, 2010. So it's a neat little thing. And they've been kind of sneaking some of these additional components in there. And it's kind of neat to see Bing starting to find some growth in an area where Yahoo's kind of just given up. You know, they were doing broadcasting for a while and just gave up on it. Seems like Bing is starting to find some ways to slip in there and find a niche.
Mark, what do you think about Bing? I mean, from your vantage point as somebody, you know, who's tracking technology and usage and whatnot, what role is it playing in the ecosystem of search engines?
Well, you know, I think Bing does have a lot of neat features, and I'm glad to see somebody, you know, competing with Google in search a little bit. I think that Bing's image search is fantastic, and it's far superior to Google's image search. Google's image search looks really dated when you compare to the way Bing operates. And so, you know, anything Bing can do to goose Google into, you know, moving forward in different areas is a good thing to me.
And interesting, as related to this, CNET reported that, you know, just that music will be part of this, just much more specialized results and things that you can see. It's kind of cool. So check it out. Tim, are these additions enough to get more people to use it? Or is Bing going to be a 5% market share play, and that'll be just fine?
Well, see, here's the thing that I've noticed about Bing is like they took a lot of existing services that Microsoft already had, and they just rebranded them as Bing. So I'm wondering if all of a sudden you'll go in to buy a Zune, and it'll just be called Bing. And if you go to get an Xbox, and it's the Bing box. So that's what I'm waiting to see, because if you like go to look at, you know, MSN video, it's now Bing, and they took all the traffic and they're counting that traffic. So
what does that mean? You think it's more of a branding play, like an umbrella sort of service?
I'm wondering. I have a wait and see attitude about it, but I have a feeling that they're putting all the might into Bing. And they seem to be doing a little bit better job of it than Disney did with that go.com. I don't know if you remember that or not.
It's awful.
If you go to Disney.com, you get redirected to go.com.disney.com or something like that. And it's just, I never figured that out. Why'd they spend so much money on go.com? And then, but anyways, I think the same thing here could be happening, but I don't know yet. And it'll be interesting to see.
All right, we'll see what happens with Bing the brand. Hulu subscription service could come potentially this week, and now we'll finally get a chance to pay for Hulu, Peter Kafka reports. CNET picked up his story. We've talked about this before, basically. You know, Hulu, there's been a lot of conjecture about whether Hulu would launch a subscription service. Apparently, this Hulu Plus, a beta test, could be starting potentially as early as this week. It's probably going to be limited to about 10,000 people to start. It would be $9.95 a month for access to a deeper catalog of shows than the free service currently offers. Plus, you could watch those shows on devices other than a laptop or a PC, which, of course, including the all-important iPad. Lon, is this going to happen, and does it matter?
I think it's inevitable that it will happen, and I think it does matter too. You know, if you look at how much, and I wonder what this is going to do to DVD sales and rentals too, depending on how how deep that catalog is, given people are paying, you know, a couple hundred bucks for a complete set of every show, their favorite shows, you know, episode ever made. You know, look at the Star Trek seasons 1 through 7 are just, it's like $180 or some $300. I forgot exactly what it costs, but it's definitely up there. I think this is great. And I think the biggest component here, if all this stuff that is spelled out in the CNET article is true, that this is actually going to remove the restrictions that Hulu has been fighting constantly over the last several years with TVs and iPads and iPhones and other devices that are not computers. I think that's a big move because once this gets on television, I think they could really see a major push forward with this.
Mark, is this vital for Hulu's survival?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think it's a great model. You know, for me, I really like Rhapsody as a music subscription service. You know, I pay $10 or $12 a month to have access to that catalog of 3 million songs. And it's just fantastic. And so if Hulu can do something like that, where I pay $10 a month and have full access to that, to their back catalog too, there's a lot of value in that. And you know, especially if it's available on all platforms, that kind of thing to me is really a fantastic model for you know, the users of the media and the providers of the media. And you know, I'm definitely in favor of media companies figuring out ways to get people to pay for media. And so the idea of offering people lots and lots and lots of searchable content for a reasonable monthly fee seems like a really good way to go.
Well, and also Sony with the PlayStation 3 game console is reportedly in talks with Hulu to offer this paid subscription service on the game and console, speaking of other devices that might be added. Tim, would you pay for it, and who do you think will pay for it?
I think this is great. I'm really excited about it because not only when you pay do you get access to Hulu's back catalog, you get access to all their commercials as well. And, you know, as a content creator, I'm all about monetizing. And so I think there's going to be some opportunities here for the independent content creator to put their content on Hulu. And through the grapevine, I hear there might be somebody we know, not me, but somebody we know that is going to be on Hulu when this launches and is going to make some revenue from commercials. So we'll see who that is. There may be a few of them. I'm excited to see who winds up with it, but that's kind of cool.
All right.
That's really cool.
We like that. We like commercials here. Final story. Let's kind of touch briefly on what's going on in Toronto with the G20 summit, which is kind of being overshadowed a little bit by protests there. Lon, I'm going to throw this to you because I know you're kind of familiar with what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is the struggle that you have, especially when, you know, sources of news media start to decline. You know, when you have a reduction in staff and resources, you know, it becomes difficult to cover both sides of the issue. And clearly that's, you know, something that's taking place here with, you know, some of the violent protests going on and some of the weightier discussions. You know, President Obama had a really interesting Q&A the other day that I watched a couple of days after the fact, because the media really was focused on the protest that day. So this is the challenge. I think it's also an opportunity for you know, for independent providers to start filling in the gaps. We're seeing that on the hyper local front that we're operating in right now, that, you know, we're going out with our print and video people covering things that have been largely ignored by larger media because they can't afford to provide that coverage anymore. So this is another area where I think independent providers might suddenly find themselves on equal footing with the Ruperts of the world.
And this might be more of a philosophical question, and I don't know that there are any easy answers, but I think one of the concerns is that, you know, the coverage is now being centered on the protests rather than the summit itself and whatever might be, you know, being figured out or discussed or whatever it is there. Mark, right or wrong, what should the coverage be centered on?
Well, it's hard not to focus on the protest when the journalists themselves are getting arrested and having sandbag you know, round shot at them. You know, we've been posting some of the videos on Boing Boing. I mean, it's pretty amazing what's going on there. And I know there's some bad actors on both sides, but when journalists aren't really allowed to do their job, and it's it's pretty clear from the videos that I'm looking at. This one woman who's holding, you know, an SLR camera and just standing there talking to the police there, and the guy raises the officer raises his rifle and blasts her with what we thought might have been tear gas at first, but later found out was a sandbag. You know, what else are you going to write about?
That's the story. Yeah. I mean, that's it. That's the story. Final thoughts on this from Tim. I mean, social media, this is just sort of another example, isn't it, of just how important social media is becoming in covering news events. I mean, I think about, other stories that we've covered over the last year, you know, important international stories where we see, you know, Twitter and just individuals communicating information kind of rising up.
Sure. I think the politicians really need to get their act together. I mean, you know, news is all about if it bleeds, it leads. So I think we're going to see people like Jesse Ventura, who has some wrestling background, get into this and really bring politics to where it needs to be so that it will get on TV. And if we just have a little bit more fighting and less of this cordial diplomacy crap, then we're going to get someplace and we're going to get stuff done because the people are going to see it.
Cage fighting. That's what we need. Cage fighting.
ultimate octagon type stuff.
Oh, Tim, on that note, where can people find you?
You can find me at onetimstreet.com.
Mark, where do you want people to find you?
Boingboing.net.
Excellent. And Lon?
You can find me at localonlinenews.tv and on Twitter, LONSEIDMAN.
And of course, you can find me at daisywhitney.com and also on Twitter at daisywhitney. This mess you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.
This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.